The New York Times is taking a look at their history of politics and the stories that they have covered over 167 years. They do so in the new book, The New York Times Book of Politics, 167 Years of Covering the State of the Union. The book is edited by Andrew Rosenthal, former editorial page editor of The New York Times, who oversaw the editorial board, the letters and op-ed departments, and the editorial and op-ed sections of NewYorkTimes.com. In March of 2016, he became a columnist and podcast contributor for The Times. Again, the name of the new book is The New York Times Book of Politics, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Andrew Rosenthal to the roundtable this morning. Andrew, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Joe. Thank you.
What brought about this project of looking at a rather odd number, I guess, of 167 years?
Well, that's just how long the New York Times has been around, so we have no control over that. But the Times came to me late last year and asked me if I would do this. They do a series of books about topics, the New York Times book on crime, the New York Times book on dining and science, and they'd never done politics. And my initial reaction was to laugh because everything is politics, but it seemed like a great challenge. So we took it on, and it seemed like the year to do it because it's all anybody talks about is politics now.
So how do you want to, when you started the project, it is finding articles that the Times has printed that gives us an idea of your coverage of this country and of our political state.
That's right. And it was a pretty daunting thing. It's obvious we couldn't do it. You know, I was working on this with my wife, Mary Beth, who's a great political student, too. And it was obvious we couldn't do it chronologically. We couldn't possibly be exhaustive. So we came up with some ideas of arranging the coverage thematically, which made it manageable. But also, I think when I looked at it, when it was done, it's good for the reader because you can either pick a topic and look at it, or you can just bounce around in the book. You don't have to follow any kind of chronological order.
So give us a sense in looking at this, through that bouncing around, of what you learned when it comes to the New York Times and their coverage of politics.
Several things. One is that there was great writing in the New York Times in the 19th century. It's not an artifact of the 20th or the 21st century. There was an enormous amount of it. There were big gaps, but that the coverage was actually quite comprehensive for the most part. I also discovered, which I knew about, but it came back very strongly, a series of kind of trends in the change of the nature of political journalism in this country. One is that the relationship between the press and the government, which has always been meant to be adversarial, became much more intensely so during the civil rights, Vietnam, and Nixon-Watergate period, and particularly after Watergate, and the McCarthy period, too, where it became apparent that there was a lot of lying going on. And the other thing that affected that was the war in Vietnam, where reporters were being sent out to cover a war, and for the first time, they had to put aside whatever their patriotism or whatever their sense of duty to the soldiers was and report what was actually happening, which was 180 degrees different from what Americans were being told by their government. And so it created this sense of distrust that you'll find. The other big trend is that starting with Nixon particularly, we started covering politicians as people and their character and their motivations more than we ever had done before.
When it comes to editors and the tone, can you see the thumbprint, if you will, of a certain editor throughout the years, or is the job for the Times to read like the Times and that there is a consistency?
It's hard to identify particular editors. I mean, there have been editors under whom Abe Rosenthal, who happened to be my father, really stressed great writing and also breadth. Max Frankel, who followed him, really took the New York Times into a new area of covering social movements starting right. and issues starting with the AIDS epidemic. But for the most part, it's fairly consistent. You see the language changing over the years because American English has changed over the years. We just don't speak the same way we did in 1872. But for the most part, you see a pretty consistent attempt to provide sensible, literate, dispassionate, well-written coverage of important issues and events.
So all the news that's fit to print and the newspaper of record to what is now often referred to by the president as the failing New York Times, does that have an impact internally? I don't know how it couldn't, but how does it have an impact? And ultimately, how do you not allow that impact to affect what you are printing?
It does have an impact. You can't be attacked 24 hours a day without feeling it. It's just we're, you know, journalists are human beings like everybody else. They're fallible and they have emotions. Journalists also have opinions, but we've been trained to keep them out of our news writing and to be dispassionate about the outcomes of the stories we're covering and to never either slant or carefully select our facts to lead to a different outcome. It's very extreme right now, and I think there are two things that we can do, one of which is in our control and one of them isn't. One of them is we just have to focus on the mission. When Thomas Jefferson said we were the fourth estate, he gave us a role in our society that's absolutely indispensable, and it's under attack. The other is you just have to you have to keep your opinions out of your news writing, and that's happening less and less these days. I think the Times is still really good about it, but it's a problem there too. Because as soon as you're identified as being a partisan, then your credibility goes out the window. Good, intelligent exercise of social media is really good. I've been quoting a line that I heard from my mother, and you probably heard it too. And that when she said to me, you know, Andrew, not every thought that comes into your brain has to come out of your mouth.
Yes.
And we could all learn that. You know, social media is an addiction in this country, and people leap to conclusions. They comment on articles they haven't read. They comment about people they've never met. It's just relentless, and it's self-perpetuating. And I think that journalists should use the social media as tools for information gathering and as for dissemination of their work, but they should not use them as platforms for expressing their personal opinions.
In putting this book together, what did you learn about the challenges of covering politics and covering politicians?
Well, some of it's logistical, you know. It's just you can't, you couldn't get the information, you couldn't deliver it, you know, that we've overcome that just enormously. The other is that I think that journalists awaken to the idea that politicians will, in fact, systematically lie to them and mislead them, and you have to be able to penetrate that without becoming completely cynical. And the other is you have to understand who these people are. And I think the other big lesson that we've learned about political coverage from 2016 and again in 2018 is that reporters need to get out of their office, they need to get off their computers, and they need to interview voters. Not at voting places, but at their homes during the campaigns, and ask them questions about how they're learning things. And what, you know, one of the questions I used to ask was, when did you decide that you liked Jimmy Carter or whoever it was? I'm just picking a person I didn't cover.
Right.
And it's fascinating to hear people tell you. And it gives you insights into how decisions are made, and that gives you, in turn, insights into how the election is going. And polling, which has used to be a crutch for political reporters, is largely worthless now. That's not quite, but it's not as useful as it used to be. So we can't fall back on that.
And that you can see that change in the New York Times 2018 campaign season versus campaign season 2016.
Yeah, I think the Times made a big effort this time around not to make the same mistakes it made in 2016, which mostly were centered around over-reliance on polling, I believe, including our own, and data, which, by the way, doesn't show you what you think it does often. And the other was not talking to voters enough and getting out of the bubble. You know, the country is not actually run by the Northeast Corridor. It's, you know, it's way more than that. Moving to another part of the country for myself, I moved out to Colorado when I was 19. It just opened my eyes, you know, because I'd grown up in this bubble, and we need to get out of those bubbles. And it's incredibly important for us to diversify our staff. And I don't just mean by the traditional senses, which are also necessary of race and gender and such, but geographical origin. We need people who have lived in parts of the country that are not in the New York, Washington, Boston corridor.
Andrew Rosen.
Or California.
Or California. Andrew Rosenthal is the editor of the new book, The New York Times Book of Politics, 167 years of covering the State of the Union. Andrew, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
It was a pleasure for me, too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, Andrew Rosenthal is the former editorial page editor of The New York Times and oversaw the editorial board, the letters and op-ed departments, and the editorial and op-ed sections of TheNewYorkTimes.com. He's currently a columnist and podcast contributor and author of the new book, The New York Times Book of Politics, 167 Years of Covering the State of the Union. The book is published by Sterling. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.